Jim Lindsay, he's great. He's a good friend of the World Affairs Council. And you know that he is the author of The People of Elder, who is president of Global Chicago, a movement affiliated to the World Affairs Council. This book can't be thrown. So I'm going to pull this. Oh, and I better say, a podcast that you can listen to when you're not listening to my podcast, Global IQ Minute, available on iTunes and everywhere else. You can listen to his podcast, which is fantastic, called The President's Inbox. And you do it weekly.
Yes, I do.
So let's just start, and then we'll open it up in a few minutes for questions. One of the criticisms that people always hear is that President Trump is very erratic, inconsistent in his views and in his policies. But when you go back and really look at his record, in 1987, he took out an ad in the New York Times, and failing New York Times, I guess it wasn't failing in 1987. And he also gave a number of speeches, and he was very consistent, it seems, in talking about immigration as well as trade. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I mean, you know, again, thank you very much for having me here. It's great to be here.
Always a pleasure.
I want to say I'm just very happy with where this time is.
Yeah.
Here at the.
I hope I have a new one by the time this ends.
this is a very nice time, very proud. Yes, you know, when I sat down to write this book, in part because he wanted to challenge the common notion that the president was a radical, well, the news coverage tends to focus on how the president reaches traditional protocols and things he tweets, and we want to really grapple with his worldview. How does the president, see the worldview? You're quite right. This is a president who has some very strong beliefs about America's role in the world, about the threats that America faces. And you mentioned the ad he took out in the New York Times back in September 1987. Also in the Washington Post and the Boston Globe, which he's also attacked on a recent occasion. And in that letter to the American people, as it was titled, he basically said that the problem facing the United States was that our allies are free riding on us, and that our trade partners use trade agreements to steal American jobs. And that if we solve those problems, we can take care of all the rest of America's problems. In many ways, if you go back and read that letter to American people, you can find on Mr. Internet, Mr. Google. It reads like a rough draft of the 2016 Republican campaign platform. And so is the president comes to the office, maybe lacking in a lot of knowledge about specifics, but very clear in terms of his point of view, who America's friends and allies are, and the giveaway of the story, they don't match up with traditional American views of who our friends and adversaries are.
You know, there's a long litany of mistakes, errors that people have talked about in the media, and also some of the people in the so-called foreign policy blog about President Trump. And yet there's a counter-argument that he has had some successes. The fact that NATO members have increased their financial commitment, first highest level official to meet with the leader of North Korea, finally perhaps making progress with the Taliban, with a negotiated settlement. So are we just, in a sense, being too critical of the president?
I don't think so.
Well, I'm not surprised.
I mean, we sort of skipped over what the president's done, and now we're just getting to the end of the story. I'm happy to start there. But the president came in and promised really big wins. And I would say, looking at now his first 2 years in office, we don't have a lot of big wins. In fact, foreign policy has turned out to be, I think, a lot harder than the president imagined. And we can sort of go through, we talk about in the book, really about sort of the three pillars of American foreign policy since the end of World War II. Really based on alliances, based on opening up markets, and trying to promote democracy, human rights, and the rule of law. And you probably, if you're looking at the president's accomplishments, it's easiest to see how little he's achieved in the area of trade. The president, again, may recall, he said, trade wars are good and easy to win. I think he's discovered in China that they may be good, but they're not easy to win. And if you look at sort of the trade space, we went through very difficult negotiations with our Canadian and Mexican friends. over NAFTA to create what is now the USMCA. Well, I don't know that Canadians refer to it by the same name. I would describe that as an agreement in which we negotiated a lot more to achieve a lot less. Actually, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which the president famously left on his third day in office, but the United States out of, implicitly had modernized NAFTA 2.0 or USMCA, if you want, put it that way. We then went back to very difficult trade negotiations. One of the things that Canadians now to administer for trade diversification. Hint, that person's job is not to try to sell or buy more from the United States, it's to find other markets for Canadian goods. And that's a big part of the problem, that if you alienate your friends, they will go elsewhere. Likewise, if you look at TPP, we left TPP, and what has happened there is that, number one, the countries that we left behind didn't do nothing. They actually negotiated their own agreement with the United States and on the outside. The Japanese then turned around and negotiated a free trade agreement with the Europeans. One of the consequences of that, if you were an out-of-work farmer in January of 2017, thinking you were going to get TPP, that would give you access to the Japanese market, something that you have been pressing political representatives to do for years. It's almost there. President Trump makes it go away. But again, it's worse than that. The Europeans turn around, negotiate a similar deal. The Japanese turn around, negotiate a similar deal with the Europeans. In essence, now it's Parmaham on Italy, I guess they're going to the Japanese market at a discount cost. Likewise, I'm from New England, and I grew up eating lobster, one of the people that hurt by Trump on the trade front in Maine lobster. Why is that? Well, when the Japanese negotiated this trade deal with the Europeans, one of the things is that the Europeans will now take lobster in from Japan, Canada, and the European Union negotiated a free trade agreement. So Canadian lobster go into Europe with no tariff, and Maine lobsters go with 8% tariff. Now, I have eaten lobsters in Maine, I have eaten lobsters in Canada, and I can tell you they taste the same.
The lobsters don't know where they are.
They don't know where they are. And so obviously you now have a situation in which Canadian lobstermen are in a, I guess, catbird seat because they're in a better position because they're providing the same commodity at a lower price. And we can multiply this over and over again. So I think particularly in the case of trade, a real problem. There's also a bigger problem, I'll step back from, which isn't foreign policy per se, which is that the president signed into law a big tax break. And one of the things that has happened with this new tax deal is that the size of deficit has grown. Just note that it will be $1 trillion this year, which means that the size of the federal budget deficit will have, in essence, doubled since Donald Trump became president. Projections are that by 2022, that we will spend as much on interest service payments on the debt as we spend for the entire Defense Department. We expect by 2028, which is less than 10 years away from us, that the size of the federal debt will be equal to about 100% of U.S. economic output. By far the highest number in U.S. history in peacetime. And this is all coming at a time when the U.S. economy is growing like gangbusters. And typically what you see in economics is that when the economy is growing really well, the deficit comes down. And that's really good because when you go into a recession, we haven't had one for a while, the deficit tends to go way back up with the so-called automatic stabilizers and the fact that if people are making less money, they pay less in taxes. So we have a big macro problem in terms of the funding for the government. It's one of the reasons why for President Trump, who ran talking about infrastructure, has done nothing about infrastructure.
Jim, I want to ask you about an issue that obviously Evo was very concerned about and interested in, because like David Hutchison, ambassador to NATO, ambassador Dahlberg held that position. And that is an issue where President Trump can say, look at the progress I've made. They're paying so much money, they're finally getting to 2%. But as you talk about in the book and also in your podcast I listen to, there's a lot more to that, a lot of history that perhaps we're forgetting.
Well, there are a couple of things. Number one, Americans have long complained about Europeans not spending enough on defense. That if you go back and read John F. Kennedy's first State of the Union address, January of 1961, he complained that Europeans weren't spending enough on defense. This has been a long-standing American complaint. Number two, this is a complaint we're actually making progress on, beginning in 2014 with the Wales Summit at NATO, which NATO members pledged by 2024 to raise their defense spending to 2% of their gross domestic product. So in essence, and that came about largely because of Russian behavior, with the Russians having seized Crimea, harassing Ukraine, European governments looked around and said, we really have neglected investments in defense, and it's time to fix that. And, of course, one of the problems you have, obviously, is every country has its own domestic politics, and it can take time to reorganize or reallocate government spending. That's why you get the 10-year glide path. And so we've seen countries begin to spend more on defense, probably not as fast as I would like, certainly, Evo or perhaps Hutchinson would like, but it's going. At the same time, the president's repeated attacks on members of NATO, questioning the validity of NATO, I think has undermined political support in Europe for that 2% target, particularly in Germany. It was always going to be a hard lift to get Germans to go to 2%. And getting Germany to go to 2% is important because Germany is by far the biggest economy.
Where are they now?
They're now like around 1.2%. Okay? And I think you're probably, best case scenario, going to get to 1.5%. But President Trump has been repeatedly attacked Chancellor Merkel, attacked Germany, attacked the EU. And this is the first president I'm aware of who was called the European Union America's foe.
But the Chancellor's been incredibly personal.
Correct. And we saw some of that in the Union Security Conference this week where I think she sort of let out some frustration built up over time. But if you sort of look at this, what is changing the conversation in Germany, where people are saying, why are we spending more on defense? But he's an American president who disrespects us. And I will note that the SPD, which is the center-left party in Germany, which is for a variety of reasons, lost considerable political support over the last several years, is now beginning an effort to reconsider whether Germany should live up to its pledges in NATO with regard to support for U.S. nuclear forces. Now, I imagine part of that is motivated by lofty intellectual concerns about how we should go reevaluate our national interests. In strategy, I think a little bit of it is also fueled by politics. That I think it's safe to say President Trump is unpopular throughout Europe, particularly in Germany. And again, then you run into the problem where countries' domestic politics can really get in the way of their cooperation with the United States.
You are such a keen observer of foreign policy and certainly of counseling foreign relations, be hard not to be. And this article appeared just about 2 weeks ago, Peggy Nunes, you may have seen in the Wall Street Journal, can Trump handle a foreign crisis? And when you think about the last 20 months or so, there really hasn't been an ongoing serious crisis, except perhaps what happened in Saudi Arabia with the murder of the journalist, Khashoggi. So, question, very short, can Trump handle a foreign crisis? And can our apparatus that has been somewhat shrunk
Short answer is we don't know because we haven't had a crisis. Indeed, traditionally, but frequently over the course of American history, presidents in their first year have had a foreign policy crisis, and historical record says that on average they haven't tended to handle it very well. Perhaps the most famous one is John F. Kennedy. was the early wall crisis. I mean, Khrushchev comes away from Freeman. Khrushchev basically thinking, I have my pocket picked. Likewise, he also has the beta pick. So, frequent lie business, John F. Kennedy is sort of, this is how things go bad your first year in office on foreign policy. The Trump administration hasn't had an episode like that, which sort of lets you to figure out, are your decision-making procedures working well? Do you have the right people in the right positions? And in essence, the first crisis can be a useful stress test. We haven't had anything like that. Now, I would say President Trump's defenders would say, there's a reason you haven't had a crisis during his first year in office, is because nobody wants to mess with President Trump. And so they're all on their best behavior. I can't prove the kind of factual for that. I would also just say more broadly, I would worry about this particular administration in a crisis, and even with the standard foreign policy, because so much of what would be a normal foreign policy national security team simply isn't seated. Okay, the Washington Post, along with the Partnership for Public Service, has a website. Every week they update it. I think my last one took it last week. They regard about 750 positions in the U.S. government as being either Senate-confirmed or important. And of those 705, of those 705, currently 150 of those slots haven't been filled. Okay. And it's not because the Senate is not acting on it, it's because this administration is incredibly slow to nominate people. Right now, I think there are at least 26 ambassadorships for which no one has been nominated. Most notably, important countries like Mexico or Turkey. And I would just say that the U.S. government is a very large entity, and the United States has a multitude of interests. And it's very hard to run it with a small staff of people. I also know at the cabinet level, we have an acting Secretary of Defense. We have an acting.
We saw that the State of the Union, everybody they were introducing acting.
So there are a lot of actings. And generally speaking, acting people cannot act with the same.
But doesn't Congress bear some responsibility? I was talking to the fellow who's been nominated to be ambassador in Morocco. And he passed through the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, but it's still held up in the Senate for a totally unrelated issue, with nothing to do with him when he came in.
Yes, the Senate, my friends in the House would say, don't blame Congress for this, blame the Senate. Since we in the House of Representatives don't have a say, passing wisely. But it is clear that some of these appointments are held up for a variety of reasons in the Senate. There's a practice called hold, which is not new to the Trump administration, where any senator can place a hold on a nominee so that person can't go forward. That happened quite a lot for President Obama during his administration. That's part of the problem. Part of the problem is that the actual process is incredibly complicated. In some sense, if you know someone who's nominated for a senior U.S. government position, the proper response might be, I'm sorry. Just the difficulty of the paperwork you have to fill out. So those things really exist. But that can explain the slowness with which this administration has nominated people. A senator can't put a hold on somebody who hasn't been nominated. And again, I will note that Jim Mattis resigned as Secretary of Defense in mid-December. We're now 2 months later, and we do not have a nominee for Secretary.
And what do you think the reason is? You cannot find anybody to take the job, or what's the reason?
Well, I think President Trump is quite comfortable with having either no people around or having people who are active. And I know that because he said that. There was an interview a year ago, he was asked about all of the empty slots in the State Department. At that time, much of the senior State Department leadership had not been filled in. And his response to it was, number one, we're saving money. We don't have to pay their salaries. And number two, it really doesn't matter because he's the one that makes decisions. So there's part of that. Recently, he was asked about why there were so many active people. And again, the interviewer's question was pointed to is that you can't get people to take the job. And his notion was, no, I actually like people who are acting. And I forget his exact words, but the general thrust was, if somebody is in a act in person, they really have to listen to me because they're hoping I might. And so it gives them a greater sense of control. That may be true. I don't think that is what the framers were thinking about when they crafted this system. And that's why, again, there are a variety of laws on the books to limit the ability of any president to sort of go around the Senate confirmation process. But there are also a variety of ways that presidents can go around the obstacles that the Congress has put in them. We're seeing that with the emergency declaration.
Well, our own subject, Congress, we have new Congress, we have new chairs of committees. What difference will we see? There was an article in the paper saying that Senator Risch is rather complacent compared to his predecessor. Would you agree with that? And you know, I have to say, too, I was just shocked last week when I saw Elliot Abrams, who was called Elliot Adams, just really carried through the fire like that. I mean, it makes you question why someone would even take a position.
Let's sort of break them out into two things. Looking at the question of Elliot, Elliot is not the first administration official, this administration or any previous administration, that has testified before Congress and been beaten up by a member of Congress. There's a long tradition of that. So I think Elliot is someone who's...
He's got a thick skin, but still is a freshman at Congress.
But it's, you know, it's, Washington can be a very tough place. The second thing about Congress, remember midterms were consequential. They were consequential because now Democrats have an institutional position in U.S. government. Back before the election, Democrats are essentially outside the building looking in. They were a minority in both the House and the Senate, and obviously didn't control the presidency. Now, once you get to control the House, that means you get to pick committee chairs. Committee chairs get to decide what committees are going to investigate. They can issue subpoenas and the like. We're already going to see a lot of that. But there are great limits to what the Democrats have, in fact, achieved. Number one, clearly Congress can investigate. The House can investigate. But it's going to find it very, very hard to legislate. And legislation can be the way in which Congress can impose its will or its vision on American law. And the problem we have here, of course, is that Republicans control the Senate. So regardless of what legislation passes the House, if the Senate doesn't agree to pick it up or doesn't like the content of it, it's not going to go further. Even in cases where you can get the House and the Senate to agree, you're in a system in which bills can be signed by the president. They also can be vetoed by the president. And historically, vetoes are difficult to override because they require you to get two-thirds plus one votes in each chamber. What that boils down to is, if a president can keep 34 members of his own party, president wins, no matter how angry everybody else is. And we saw this play out on recent legislation, which was a vote on U.S. support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen. And it passed in the Senate last Congress. But the House did not pick it up before that session ended. So you have to start the whole process over. We had a vote earlier this month in which the House voted for this. It's likely to come to the Senate in the next 3 or 4 weeks. I would expect the Senate to pass it again, but you will probably only get about 54 to 55 votes, and that is well short of what you need to override the veto. So it means, in some sense, there'll be a lot of sound and fury, but it will signify nothing. If I can paraphrase, somebody's a part of it right at night.
We talked a few days ago, you told me your inbox was stacked full with emails about the Munich Security Conference. I said, I didn't realize that the conference had been going on for over 50 years. So give us the context of the meeting, what is its purpose, and then tell us what's coming through your inbox.
Well, think of the Munich Security Conference as the premier event of the transatlantic relationship, where you have significant people get together to talk about the challenges and accomplishments of the transatlantic alliance, which is really the bedrock, the foundation of the U.S.-led order that's existed since the end of World War II. Now, sometimes in the past, those meetings could be quite fractious because While we have an alliance, we're very close to our allies, that doesn't mean we haven't fought. We fought in the 60s over Vietnam, in the 80s over arms control and the like, in the early 2000s about invasion of Iraq. So these meetings aren't always, get together, everybody's clapping each other in the back. Sometimes they can get quite pointed. But I think this meeting this year is different. And it's different because the problem we face in transit, it might get, relationship has changed. The previous things I talked about, Vietnam, the deployment of cruise missiles and Pershing 2s, the Iraq War, those were differences over policy. Now what we're facing in the transatlantic relationship are differences over purpose. Again, the President of the United States, who's deeply skeptical of this alliance, the value it has said on the air, why are we defending the Montenegrins? They're an aggressive people that can drag us into a war. He's called the European Union a foe. Words that he hasn't used to describe, thus we call America traditional adversaries to the Russians. This is causing a great deal of alarm. Now, I think leaders in Europe, when Donald Trump was elected, were surprised. They thought that Secretary Clinton could become President Clinton. And their hope was that for everything that candidate Trump said on the campaign trail, that in essence, he'd come around to a more traditional American style of leadership. There's a lot of talk, you probably heard about the Committee to Save the World, or the Axis of Dulles, that President Trump's sort of mainstream advisors like Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State, Jim Mattis, as Secretary of Defense, who sort of push President Trump onto a more traditional platform. Which was why I think you can sort of sum up the way Europe approached the Trump presidency in the first 2 years in the following way, which was don't isolate him. Don't give in to him, don't give up on him. And I think what we saw in the Munich conference over the week, in essence, is the clearest evidence yet that European leaders are giving up on him. That they're not going to be able to change his mind. That a president who, in essence, campaigned by saying, I want our allies to do more, is not satisfied when they're willing to do more. In fact, is not willing to engage them, taking up on their offers to do more, whether we're talking about the Iran nuclear deal or how to confront China over its predatory trade practices. They view this as a president that's fundamentally hostile to them. And on the horizon, I think for many Europeans, and particularly Germans, is the expectation that this president is going to impose tariffs on automobiles sometime this year and really sort of throw a wrench in the economic.
But in a sense, too, we're becoming more isolated.
Well, very
it's not just give up, it's being isolated.
Well, in essence, what we're seeing increasingly is, and this is not just Europe, but broadly beyond the Munich Security Conference, what you are seeing is that America's friends and allies have realized that they have to work around the United States and they have to work without the United States. And I think that has very real consequences when we're talking about security issues. Particularly clear, we're talking about economic issues. Before, the fact is, the United States or the Trump administration doesn't like trade agreements as they have traditionally practiced. Other countries said, okay, but we're going to keep doing deals. And part of the problem is that when they're out doing deals, American economic interests get left out, which is saying in diplomacy, if you are not at the table, you are on the menu. This is why when we look at this, when countries sit down and the United States isn't there, our interests aren't going to be protected. Now, it may have been in the past that people would say, the U.S. wasn't there, but we owe the United States something, so we'll try to represent their views. But I think increasingly that's not the case.
I think one of the things in this room, people wanted Rex Tillerson to be successful. And when Secretary Pompeo came in, I think largely the State Department breathed a sigh of relief that things would change. But then Secretary Pompeo gave a very strong speech in Brussels. How do people view him now? Because it seems that he's pretty much following the president's line of thinking.
Inside the building or outside?
Both.
I think inside our building, that moment of elation, that now the Secretary of State is going to value us, and he's going to advance us, and he's going to protect us, those two feelings are gone. I think there's just a deep sense of resignation. And I do think this is a problem that is likely to have long-term consequences. We have seen over the last couple of years an exodus of people leaving the upper ranks of the State Department. People who are working organizations know that it can be really hard to replace your best people. Good people leave, that's a problem, because usually the people who stay behind are less adept or certainly more junior. You can lose a lot of institutional memory. And I will tell you, as somebody who worked in the U.S. government, it's actually a lot more difficult to get things done than you would ever imagine. Even if you spent your lifetime studying politics, getting inside the machinery and getting it to work is really a lot different than just writing about it. It's one thing to sit up in the stands and complain about the calls that Dallas Cowboys coach is doing. It's quite another thing to actually have to call the plays yourself and design the plays in the rest of it. So I think that's going to be a problem going forward. We're seeing a lot of the agencies, people leaving. Likewise, it's very hard to make the case, as I was asked to do when I was at Duke University a couple of weeks ago, to young people who say, yes, you should go into government service because the rewards are so great. Yes, there's a problem with government shutdowns and the president saying you're not really needed, but brush that aside, there's no problem to do it. So I think that's something. Outside of the building, I think when you look at Secretary Pompeo, I think the sense is, particularly in Europe, that Secretary Pompeo, when he gave that speech you mentioned in Brussels, he had an audience of one. And I do think that, I was happening in Paris at the time, when the speech was given in Brussels, and then a bunch of people who were in Brussels happened to come to the
meeting. You got
the blowback. Well, they came to the meeting I was at in Paris, and I would only describe it as it sort of went back and forth between sheer horror and deep anger. That they sort of felt like this was someone who came in and deliberately inside of them. And I think there's in many ways the same feeling in Europe to the Warsaw conference that was held, I guess, last week about the Middle East. And I think Vice President Pence's speech at the Munich Security Conference went over similar. Again, I think there's a clear sense among many, I guess, friendly countries that they are not respected or treated well, and they feel that they're, in some things, like that they feel that they're props in a bigger story.
One of our members who told me right away that he was opposed to President Trump, and he may be in the room, wanted your thoughts on what would be the lasting effect on U.S. foreign policy after President Trump leaves office, whether it be in 2020 or 2024. And he also, let me ask you to respond to that, but also add a bit more definition. What do you think will be the impact on our institutions and on our global role? Can we, to follow your premise, recapture the role of leadership that we are leading?
That is a question I get asked every time I do one of these things, and it's the hardest question to answer because I don't know what the state of affairs will be when there's a new president in the White House, whether that is in January 2021 or January 2025. Obviously, time will matter, but also events. I think there's been a tendency to think that whatever we have seen so far is as bad as it could get. I think, again, it could actually get much worse. It can get much worse because, again, the president doesn't believe in the benefits of an American-led order. Or maybe a different way to put it is he thinks that if he demands more from others and pushes people around, that he will simply get for the United States a bigger slice of the pie, and the pie itself will stay the same. What's more likely to have happened is that, in cooking terms, the taste and consistency of where you're baking is going to change and become unpalatable. And again, when you think of some of the things that could happen in the weeks and months to come, what would the impact be of tariffs on autos imported from Japan or from Europe? What would be the consequences if the president goes to Illinois later this month and we continue down this road where We keep saying nice things about the North Koreans, and they don't take anything approaching a verifiable step to denuclearize. What if that is tied to the president announcing a peace agreement or he's going to order a scaling back of U.S. troops in North Korea? These are all things that will have big knock-on effects, which is really hard to predict. Okay? Now that I've covered my bases, what I will also say is that I do think that the next president of the United States will be potentially the luckiest man or woman in the world if he or she decides to take advantage of it. Why is that? Because I do think that there is a desire for American leadership around the world, particularly among our traditional friends and allies. So why is that? Part of it is people just used to have it. Okay, I'll help them see this happen. But also, why is it self-interest? It's self-interest because people realize for them to accomplish or achieve their security, their prosperity, it really helped to have the United States involved. And that was true of traditional problems like great power rivalry and life. But it's become even more important as we increasingly move into a world of transnational problems. We no longer live in a world in which problems sort of stay where they start. They cross borders, terrorism, climate change, predatory trade practices, disease. We can go through a laundry list of things where, you know, if you want to do something about it, you have to mobilize people. And the fact is, you know, one concept for this is the collective action problem. How do you get people to act, you know, to solve a common problem when they have a tendency to want somebody else to take the lead? And the United States, by dint of, again, history, by dint of the fact we are the most powerful country, or we are the most vibrant, by the fact that we are, even with President Trump, the most admired country. And it's really interesting. There's a lot of polling done about across the world, done by people, excellent polling, asking them, you know, what you think of American presidents. It's where the world really liked Barack Obama, doesn't really like President Trump. And yes, there are exceptions to this. President Trump is popular in Israel, popular in Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. So you have it. Now, the other is a different question. You know, people tend to spend less time paying attention to, which I think is much more valuable. When Pew asks people around the world, who would you like to see as the dominant power in the world? The United States said choice above the Chinese and above the Russians. And that's because the American life, the American creed, the notion of individuality and liberty, is still very appealing. Now, I think it's getting scuffed up in some very important ways, but I think it is still incredibly powerful. And I would put it the way it was put to me by a Japanese diplomat, as we talk about history, generally gave us the title of the book. And he was talking about, he said, fundamentally, what we had to understand, looking out at the world, is that China has clients, America has friends. You don't want that to change.
I think that's a good note to open it up to the audience. Let's hear from all of you. Ray, you get the first question. And who else has questions so we can just see where our last question is.
Of the recent presidents, let's say between 1980 and 2016, which president would you say had the most successful foreign policy? And which has had the worst?
Okay. The president I thought had the best foreign policy, I don't even think it's a contest. It's George H.W. Bush. No one's even close to it. And again, I have to give late President Bush great credit because he sort of intuitively understood two critical things. One is that if you're willing to work with others, you can accomplish great things. And you think about the job he did in building the coalition in the Gulf War, but I think even more so, and this is, I think, lost on most Americans, the absolutely spectacular job he did handling the collapse of the Soviet Union and the reunification of Germany. Don't forget when all of a sudden the Germans began talking about reunification, most of Europe maybe went back to 1945. Margaret Thatcher, dead set against it. President of France, dead set against it. Why? Because they fear the United Germany. George H.W. Bush's view is we shouldn't be fearful of it. And he really midwifed something quite remarkable, I think. I can get my vote on that. I think the worst, I wouldn't necessarily talk about it in terms of worst presidents. If I were to talk about worst decisions, I would say President George W. Bush's decision to invade Iraq, I think. History will, it has been kind to and won't be kind to. Because in essence, the younger Bush failed to recognize something the older Bush did. Josh just forgot to mention those are two things. The second thing the elder George Bush realizes that it is best not to go a step too far. It's better to come just a little bit short of your maximum rather than to go past your maximum. That's clearly what George H.W. Bush did in choosing not to go to Baghdad, even though a lot of people who wanted to go to Baghdad. I think what President George W. Bush failed to recognize is that you can take on too much. And I think we're still living with the consequences of that decision. But I can give you, you know, bad decisions 2 through 15 if you want later on. I don't want to say that President George W. Bush is the only president to have done things that and probably were unwatched.
And let me recommend Jim Engel's book, Let the World Seem New, if you've not read it, don't really understand that issue. We got a question in the very back. I thought I saw one of a hand. All right, let's do that. And then we have a lady here right there, and then George Hobbins for you.
Thank you very much for being here. I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about immigration, about refugees in Jordan and Lebanon and all elsewhere around the world. Missions in the United States, and also, of course, our southern border.
Yeah. I'm a little nervous answering the question because Jim Hollifield from Southern Methodist University is right here in the front row. He's forgotten more about immigration than I know. So, but I'm just going to answer your question, but I don't want to put that up in front. This is a president who I think is been very clear. He wants to drive down both illegal and legal immigration. That's been the case for quite a while. One of his main policy advisors, Stephen Miller, has been very vocal on this. I think the president's statement in the State of the Union address earlier this year that he was for increased legal immigration doesn't coincide with what his administration has actually done. I do think that when we talk about the refugee situation we have in the Middle East, it's quite significant, as you point. It's not simply a matter of refugees, that people leave their country and go elsewhere, but also what in the business is called IDPs, internally displaced people, of which there were a great number. These movements of refugees across the border are clearly putting a great deal of strain on the host countries, obviously in Turkey, in Jordan. There was a lot of speculation early on that a country like Jordan potentially would be destabilized by the presence of those large numbers, several hundred thousand refugees. That hasn't proven to be the case, but some of these things can sort of develop overnight. I would situate in a broader problem that we have worldwide something on the order of 25 million refugees. And we have a variety of international agreements that govern them. And I think governments are having a great deal of difficulty living up to their obligations under those agreements. I will note that refugees have really fueled a lot of division in Europe. It's not the only issue, but clearly you sort of look at the divide. It's called Eastern Europe or Southern Europe and Northern Europe. Refugees have been a big issue. Refugees obviously have been a big issue in a variety of countries in Europe, including in Germany. And I think there are many members of Chancellor Merkel's own party believe she made a mistake.
Brexit
is another example. That also has other roots. I want to reduce everything to refugees. I will note as you look forward, we are going to see more refugees. We're going to see more refugees, we're seeing more migrants, either because people are leaving because of state failure, where they live, desired to find a better life. That has been the history of the world. People move and vote with their feet. That is likely to continue. And I'm not sure that we are prepared internationally how to deal with it. On the southern border, I don't know how much I have to add to a broader conversation, which is, you know, if you're thinking about it in terms of flows of illegal immigrants in the United States, it's actually a net flow in the other direction. It has been for several years now. The numbers at the border are way down. Immigrants crossing the border aren't the ones that are bringing drugs into the country. Most of those are coming through legal ports of entry, you know, or tunnels dug under walls and things like that. If your question, do I think we have a national emergency today because of the problem at the border? I would say no. It doesn't mean that I would consider it to be the standard national emergency. And President Trump, announcing it, seemed to indicate he didn't think so either by saying he didn't want to do it, he just wanted to get it done fast, which I think sort of runs counter to what we normally think of as qualifying as a national security. Just one last thing I'll say. I think America's immigration policies have broken for a long time. Nothing surprising there. Unfortunately, there's no reason to believe that we're any closer to finding agreement in Congress on an immigration policy that makes sense.
I want to touch on your comment about the senior staff leading the State Department national security. Should there be a different president, or there will at some point be a different president, do you think those people would ever go back to those jobs, or have we lost that expertise?
The government works differently than the private sector does. You know, if you're working for ExxonMobil and you decide to go work for ConocoPhillips, ExxonMobil can hire you back down the road. Or if you work for Google, you can go work for Amazon and come back to Google.
Can you take a leave of absence for a year or two with approval? Or?
You can in certain circumstances, but that's not what most of these people do. In essence, they are deciding that they are no longer a Foreign Service officer, or they're no longer a civil servant, they're going to leave. And so it's really hard to replace people at the upper echelon. And again, when you think of it, the senior people are a reservoir of ideas on how to get things done. And
the relationships that they've built up over years.
I was going to just give you an example. I went in 1996 to go work in the White House. At that point, I was a tenured professor of political science. I had written two books all about American foreign policy, and I showed up at the White House. And I was sort of like the country mouse that had moved to the city. I was totally overwhelmed by everything. And I worked on a variety of issues, but I was always struck by one gentleman in particular. His name is Princeton Line. He was the Assistant Secretary of State for International Organizations. And I was working on an issue, I was at the White House. I was working on an issue about U.S. arrears to the United Nations, and I got to work with Ambassador Lyon. And he had, at this point, been in the service probably 30 years. He had been U.S. ambassador to South Africa when Nelson Mandela was freed, and U.S. ambassador to Nigeria. And it was the interesting thing was just how much I learned from him about how to make things happen in government, who to talk to, what to do, what to say to people, what not to say to people, what letters to pull to get things done. And I had a great pleasure. Subsequently, Ambassador Lyman came to work for me at the Council on Foreign Relations. But I was always, as I told Princeton, it was just, I took so much of what I learned was working with people like him, because they were able to share their experience. They had been to one or two rodeos before. And I don't know, what's the old saying? You know, good judgment comes from experience. Experience comes from bad judgment. It's helpful to get people sort of help you short circuit that sort of thing. So you're not going to get that kind of movement. I do think that for the next president, presumably, and again, it depends on who that person is, that a lot of people who are on the outside now will happily go and work for them. One of the challenges that President Trump had was that his views were so extreme in the eyes of many, these are called traditional Republicans, that they in essence took themselves out of the running. And you have the Never Trumpers who said, no way, no how will I work for this president. And I do know people were thinking about going into this administration, way that, you know, sort of the reputation effect that it might have on them, because people were very critical of the president's foreign policy.
Let's see, we have a few more questions, and I'm going to ask you to be just a little briefer, but not that much. But let's go. Is that Lee back there? Hi, Lee. Lee, and then there's a lady right next to Lee as well. And Alana. And George, you're going to get the last question, so don't worry.
Jeff, thank you. Your observations are really very compelling. You mentioned Maribel, you mentioned Brexit, Jim. What do you see ahead for Europe when Maribel departs and Britain probably departs as well?
I see a great deal of turbulence. I mean, Europe has a number of problems. One, it has economic problems, partly because of high levels of debt. Partly it has to do with we're seeing a global economy that is slowing. This is going to create problems. But you have real deep division within Europe about what the future of Europe is meant to be. And the most obvious evidence of that is the decision by British voters to leave the European Union. I suspect we're going to have Brexit. It will not end up well for the British, certainly in the short term. You know, one of the interesting things is recently major manufacturers have voted to leave a variety of closed-down operations in Britain because they were in Britain because it was an export platform to the rest of the EU. And when Britain leaves the EU, it ceases to be an export platform. They pay tariffs, they don't want to pay tariffs. So you move. It's a sort of cold-blooded calculation. I think the real challenge for Europe is that it's not clear there are leaders who can command followers. And I'll go back when President Macron was elected, there was a great deal of hope that he was going to be sort of the energy that would sort of reinvigorate Europe, help it finally discover its mojo, and for a whole variety of reasons, some of his own missteps, he no longer can play that particular role. So I don't see anyone in Europe emerging as a leader to make things happen, and then you have a collective action problem where things fall apart because nobody can actually get it going.
Is there a precedent for the reduction in force at the State Department at this level? Any precedent that can give us some indication of what to expect in the future?
No. I mean, this is the first president who has taken this attitude toward the State Department. There have been plenty of presidents who've come in with a new sheriff in town, want to do things differently, did a lot of changing at the top. Ronald Reagan, George W. Bush come to mind. But those were presidents and administrations that wanted to use the State Department. Again, you look at Ronald Reagan, you know, he had one of the greatest secretaries of state, namely George Shultz, which was a gentleman who really knew how to use the building. Likewise, I think that Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, very much wanted to use the building. So this is a presidency which has a very different view of president, a very different view of how to use these institutions. Laura?
So we snuck my question about Angela Merkel. So I'll take this opportunity to ask a different question. How do you see the crowded Democratic field of candidates that have since announced their run? How do you see foreign policy playing out?
Yes. Well, my first reaction is to weep. And let me explain why. I have a blog called The Water's Edge. And this is now my third presidential election. And I made a commitment that I would profile every candidate who entered the race. That didn't seem so bad back in 2012. 2016 nearly wore me out with 16, 17 Republicans running for the primary. for the nomination, and I think that if we really do get 30 Democrats running the election, I'm going to be a broken human being. I think the really interesting thing to watch is, do Democratic candidates talk about foreign policy? And if so, what do they say? And I'm now, I guess, in six posts so far on various candidates. Most candidates aren't talking about foreign policy at all. But to the extent they do, they tend to echo Donald Trump in many of his criticisms. And I think that has a lot to do with the takeaway we have from the 2016 election, where the conventional wisdom is that Donald Trump campaigned against traditional American foreign policy and then he won. So it must be that the American public is abandoning or dislikes traditional foreign policy. This is a classic case of what logicians refer to as the post hoc ergo propter hoc fallacy. It simply means after that, because of that. Just because B follows A doesn't mean that A caused B. And it is, people who are professional political scientists have actually said, this notion that the 2016 election was about the losers of globalization rising up and wreaking revenge doesn't have much empirical basis. That wasn't what drove the election. But I worry that many Democrats come away convinced that the public wants to turn inward, wants to do less, is in essence afraid of the world.
But there have been some polls that have shown that that's not what they are.
That's exactly the point. If you look at, you mentioned Nevo, who's my co-author, he's the president of Chicago Council. They've been doing polls on this for 4 years. And what's really interesting is if you think of presidents being engaged in a conversation with the public about which way to go, on foreign affairs, Donald Trump is losing. On almost every issue where he takes a stance, the public has moved in the other direction. And that is not simply because Democrats don't like President Trump. We're seeing the same movement among independents and also among
George Yates, final question.
Plenty to criticize on foreign policy. Are there any areas where you're tempted to applaud even lightly? Bring your attention to a couple of issues I'd like to comment on. One is opening the conversation about China and various abuses, the potential of reform. And the second is really focusing the spotlight on Germany's policy with North Stream 2. Major issues.
No, I don't think everything President Trump does is wrong. I would say with respect to the Nord Stream issue, it's very common. It pushed the Germans to realize that they are increasing their dependence on Russia and that has geopolitical consequences. I also think that there are probably better ways to go about doing that that would be more likely to get you the outcome that you want. Sometimes you attract more flies to the honey than the vinegar. As the saying goes, I think this is a case in point. I think that, if you look at China, I would give the president great credit for putting it on the table. But I think that comes again with two caveats. One, I'm not sure what the president's trying to accomplish. There's a great uncertainty about what we're trying to achieve, whether it is simply driving down the bilateral trade deficit, whether it's trying to get the Chinese to end intellectual theft, whether it's trying to open up the Chinese market for American firms, whether it is about trying to get China to abandon state-owned enterprises, or whether it's fundamentally about trying to decouple Chinese economy from the American economy. I don't know what the objectives are, and I think the latter several are likely to be very, very difficult to achieve, and particularly costly to the United States. I would also say, this again gets me back to the central irony of the Trump administration. This is the president who campaigned by saying others aren't doing enough, but a number of issues China trade quite clearly. Others have said, we want to help. And our response has been, don't bother. And I think that is a major goal. I think is missing an opportunity, because eventually what you really want to do is to codify some of these rules that are others are going to follow as well.
And I want to thank you again for being
with
us. And then Central wearing, already wearing proudly World First Council tie for Mrs. Lindsay.
Oh, thank you very much.
And then we also have members who you know. And we have members, as you know, who love to read. If I mentioned, someone teased me last night, Marjorie. They said, usually when you finish the program, you say, you read the book and you enjoyed it. And we did Churchill last night, and that book is 982 pages, and I have not read it. But I have read this book, and it is worth you getting it and reading it. It really sets in a very contextual way just everything that we've been reading in the papers.